Washington Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session. The Honorable James Cohen presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Packed house. First up is State versus Barutovaj.
Good morning. May it please the court. David Koch here on behalf of Mr. Barutovaj. Seated with me at council table is Inoka Hirat from the WDA Immigration Project. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. It is my intention to give up at least a couple of my minutes to Ms. Hirat so the court will have the benefit of her expertise on immigration matters. The issue I want to focus on this morning is the denial of the Criminal Rule 7.8 motion. As this court's aware, Mr. Barutovaj attempted to undo the rather devastating consequences of going to trial, which resulted in 3 Class B felony convictions, a 57-month sentence, and automatic deportation, and instead requested that he be permitted to plead guilty to assault in the third degree with sexual motivation. Now, it was his obligation to show both deficient performance and prejudice by his defense counsel, starting with deficient performance. Not even the state has attempted to sort of defend the action or inactions of defense counsel down below in terms of their handling of plea negotiations and the immigration issues specifically.
When we get to the prejudice prong, and I read Loeffler, it seems to me that court says, if no plea offer is made, the issue raised here simply does not arise. Was an offer made here?
An offer was made, but I think a distinction needs to be drawn between a formal offer and a non-formal offer. It is true that there was no formal offer made here. The idea for assault in the third degree actually came from the prosecutor's office. They were the first one that floated it, Mr. Barber. And, of course, they continued to ask about it right up to almost the eve of trial, the week before trial, where Mr. Barber was asking or saying last chance for either CMIP or assault in the third degree.
Were material terms not included in that offer, though? Just contract formation.
I think the only thing that apparently was missing, according to Mr. Barber, was that it had to be run by the powers that be. And he later, during the hearing on all this, explained that that simply meant his supervisors. Now, the one thing...
Is that important?
It's not important.
I assume you say it's not important, but why not?
It's not important because there's every indication in this record that ultimately a plea deal would have been reached. And the reason I say that is because this is a situation where both parties were open to a plea deal. The state was certainly not seeking deportation of my client. We also know that they were willing to...
How would you distinguish this from traditional contract analysis, where there has to be a meeting of a minds, not an intent to meet in the future?
Well, I think at this point there was a meeting of the minds. The only thing that the state has said in this case as to why there would not have been a formal offer and why there would not have ultimately been a plea deal is that they would have been unwilling to sanitize the conviction and the plea to exclude references to the victim's age. That's the only reason they've ever stated down below or on appeal as to why this deal would not have been consummated. That is the one precondition they say that was not met.
Is there any evidence in the record that the deputy prosecutor's supervisors would have approved the deal?
I think the evidence in the record is that, I guess I could turn that around and say there's no evidence they would not have approved the deal.
Doesn't that hurt you, though?
I don't think so. I mean, presumably the prosecutor doesn't float these proposals unless there is a chance that it's going to be approved by the supervising attorney. And again, the state is not even taking the position that the supervising attorney would have said no for any other reason other than they weren't willing to get rid of the date of birth. But we now know that that wasn't necessary in order to...
Let me analogize this to a personal injury claim settlement. The attorney says to counsel on the other side, I'm pretty sure my client will take the deal if you offer another $5,000. The other side puts the $5,000 on the table. But there's never any evidence that the first attorney talked to the client and got the client to approve it. Do you have a settlement?
You don't have a settlement, but I think you need to go back to the language of Loeffler. Okay, Lafler, I realize there was a formal offer in Lafler, but what Lafler v. Cooper says is the question is whether there's a reasonable likelihood that there would have been a consummated deal. In other words, an offer by the state that was acceptable to defense that would have been accepted by the court. That seems to be their analysis. Now, again, I understand there was a formal offer in there, but as a practical matter, there really is no distinction between the situation in Lafler where you have a formal offer that's then rejected because of deficient representation versus what's going on in this case where the only reason you don't have a formal offer that would have been consummated by all the parties is because of the deficient representation of the attorneys. It's the same as far as the defendant is concerned. In both situations, he's denied the opportunity of the best possible outcome. So I think under Lafler, the question really in terms of IAC is whether there's a reasonable probability that a deal would have been reached. And in this case, on this record, the answer is yes. And again, because the only reason the state is saying that they wouldn't have made that formal offer, this is the only reason that's ever been offered, is that they wouldn't have been willing to cleanse the record of the date of birth of the victim. But we now know, and defense counsel would have known if they had simply placed a call to WDA, that that wasn't necessary to avoid deportation. So the one premise, factual premise, as to why this deal would never would have been consummated really is not a barrier at all. It's a false barrier, and defense counsel would have recognized that had he complied with his Padilla duties and investigated and discovered this. And again, that's really what this, where the state is hanging their hat in this case, is on that prejudice prong that there wouldn't have been a formal offer, but it's only based on that premise, and it falls because it's a false premise.
Was the 7.8 hearing an evidentiary hearing? Was there a request for an evidentiary hearing if it wasn't one? And are there questions of fact that need to be resolved?
There was a request. Mr. Zuckerman actually pointed out to the court that if you know there were factual disputes that need to be resolved regarding Mr. Brown's representation, that a hearing would be the appropriate place to do it. Judge Eady apparently didn't feel there was a need for that because he, like the state, focused on the fact that there wouldn't be this cleansing of the record, therefore there wouldn't have been a formal offer, therefore there wouldn't have been a plea agreement. But there are unresolved questions in terms of Mr. Brown's representation. I think we have enough of the questions resolved for this court to reverse just based on the handling of the plea negotiations. But we also have this other sort of contributing factor as well as to what was said with regard to the chances at trial and encouraging him to go to trial based on really false premises. Those have not been resolved. And if this court deems appropriate, then it would be suitable to send that back for an evidentiary hearing. Unless the court has any of the other questions of me right now, I do want to go ahead and relinquish the floor to Ms. Herat to answer any of the court's questions about immigration. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Broadwaj's lawyer failed in his Padilla duties. He didn't investigate immigration consequences, and that tainted his entire representation. Mr. Broadwaj's paramount goal was to avoid deportation, and the charge offense would have resulted in automatic deportation. The state suggested assault third with sexual motivation, and that would have avoided deportation. But Mr. Broadwaj's attorney didn't know that because he made no effort to discover what the immigration consequences were.
Under the modified categorical approach the Ninth Circuit was advocating or using at the time of these negotiations, what's the result of the assault three?
Well, assault three with sexual motivation wouldn't have even gotten to the modified categorical approach. It's not even in the realm of sexual abuse of a minor aggravated felonies. There's no case law, published or unpublished, finding that assault third was a sexual abuse of a minor aggravated felony. And there's, I mean, even under, even Aguila Montes de Oca required some overlap of the elements before an immigration judge could even look at, go to the modified categorical approach and look at the record of conviction. And in this case, that overlap doesn't exist at all. I mean, there isn't a single case where a negligent offense has been found to be sexual abuse of a minor aggravated felony. And there's, and the statute lacks minor as an element of a crime. But in the absence of case law directly on point, there is always a risk, however theoretical, and to eliminate that risk, the best practice was and still is to sanitize the record. So even though there wasn't a risk actually based on case law, you know, in the absence of case law, we would always suggest to sanitize the record. But if that wasn't done, we still would have told him, assault third with sexual motivation avoids deportation. It's the best plea for your client, even with an unsanitized record.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Andrea Vilich from the King County Prosecutor's Office on behalf of the state of Washington. In this case, regarding the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel based on the plea bargaining phase of the case, Lafler v. Cooper requires five things. First of all, that the prosecutor makes an offer. Secondly, the defense attorney renders inadequate or deficient advice. Thirdly, the defendant rejects the offer based on the deficient advice. Fourth, the defendant would have accepted the offer but for the deficient advice. And finally, that the court would have ratified the plea. Here, the defendant and the amicus focus almost solely on number two, that the defense attorney rendered deficient advice. However, none of the other requirements are met here.
If the email comes through, last chance for third degree assault with sexual motivation, and the response had been, we'll take it. Do you have an offer and an acceptance?
I think what you have there is a preliminary step towards formalizing the offer. And I disagree with counsel strongly that a formal offer is not required, because it's axiomatic that plea agreements are governed by contract law. And under contract law, you don't have an offer when there's merely an invitation to negotiate. What I think you have there is certainly a point at which the parties would have to hash out the terms of the contract. However, as Lafler states, if the prosecutor would have withdrawn the offer at some point due to intervening circumstances, you still don't have a claim under Lafler. And under these circumstances where everyone is agreeing that the best practice to avoid deportation, even now that the law is clearer than it was when this case was negotiated, would involve sanitizing the record, we know that the state would not have agreed to that.
But Lafler talks about the reasonable probability standard, and there's authority that that's less than a preponderance. It's kind of, could this deal have legs, and why isn't there an argument to say, yeah, we'd like to have the sanitized record, but even without that, we're in.
Well, the problem there, again, I think this gets us so far in beyond Lafler and into the realm of speculation. It extends Lafler beyond its necessary boundaries, which is that we know that there's an offer and what the terms were, what the advice was, and that the defendant rejected the offer based on the advice. In that case, we don't know that the defendant would have accepted an offer that said, well, you know, the prosecutor's not willing to sanitize the record. As Mr. Zuckerman stated, quote, every immigration lawyer I know would advise sanitizing the record, but the state's not willing to do that. So therefore, there is a risk of deportation. Would the defendant have accepted that offer?
His declaration from his expert immigration attorney seems pretty clear that he's saying, hey, I'd tell him to take that no matter what else was in play.
But again, we have to know whether the defendant would have accepted that offer. And when
probability he would have.
Well, given the record states that his paramount goal was to avoid deportation, and here we're talking about a situation where the law was unclear at the time. The law is clearer now, but we have to judge what happened based on the law at the time.
But that only goes to the performance standard, right? That doesn't go to prejudice. The uncertainty about where the law is. That's only on performance.
But I think here it actually does go to prejudice, because it calls into question whether the defendant would have accepted the offer under those circumstances. And once again, that gets back to my primary argument, which is we're so far beyond the scope of Lafler at this point, because there wasn't an offer, that we're merely left in a position where we're speculating. What would the terms of the offer have been? What advice would have been given if there was a formal offer? Would the defendant have accepted the offer, given that law at the time was unclear, and the defendant would have been advised that the best practice was to sanitize the record? I also disagree with counsel when he states that the only basis upon which the state is provided for not actually tendering an offer to assault in the third degree was the sanitization of the record. The prosecutor's declaration also states that he would have been consulting with the victim and her family, and that they had expressed during the pendency of the case, that a plea to a charge that did not acknowledge the power differential and the age difference between the defendant and the victim was not acceptable to them. So that's another grounds upon which this could be easily called into question.
What does the record tell us about the prosecutor always deferring to the wishes of the victim or the victim's family?
Particularly in these kinds of cases, I mean, there's two components there. He would have to have it approved by his supervisors, and he also would have consulted with the victim, and the record indicates...
What does the record tell us the prosecutor's policy is if the victim or the victim's family opposes the proposed plea bargain?
It doesn't establish that, but it does establish that he would have consulted and in addition have it approved by his supervisors. I can tell you what the policy is, but that's not in the record.
Well, we only get to look at the record.
I understand that, and that's why I'm holding back on that.
On your characterization as no formal offer being made here, and forgive me if I'm going back to contracts class, we have an email.
Correct.
Saying certain things. Why is that not a formal offer?
Because the terms of the offer in this case would have included not only what the jail time recommendation would be, but also what the terms of any community custody would have been. And in this case, I think that would have been problematic. So there's a number of components, obviously, to a plea offer. It's not just this is the crime, this is the sentence we're going to or the time in jail that we're going to recommend.
So you're not just saying that paper has to be exchanged. You're saying this email is incomplete in terms of everything that would have been included within the offer.
I think what the email establishes is an invitation to negotiate. Beyond an invitation to negotiate, I think, again, we're left to speculate. Because there are really no terms. In fact, the recommendation for jail term isn't even included. Simply, I believe the standard range is mentioned at some point.
So your answer essentially is this email lacks essential elements.
Yes.
Okay.
In terms of what constitutes an offer, which it must necessarily include some terms that would be accepted in exchange for some form of consideration. And that's simply lacking in this case.
Are there evidentiary questions left to be resolved?
No. Thank you, Your Honor, for reminding me. That was another thing I was going to address. Mr. Zuckerman, at the hearing on the 7.8 motion, conceded that there wasn't a formal offer, number one, and number two, that any immigration attorney that he knows would have recommended sanitizing the record of the plea and the sentencing. So those being the two grounds upon which the trial court focused, those issues were resolved and not disputed, and so therefore there was no need for a further evidentiary hearing. The counsel for Amicus stated that even without a sanitized record, that an assault third with sexual motivation is, I believe the terms were, not in the realm of an aggravated felony involving sexual misconduct against a minor. But then I would question why it is that that recommendation would have been made at the time, and why, when the prosecutor consulted with Ms. Benson prior to the 7.8 hearing, he was told that that is what should have been done. So, again, I think we're in a situation where what Strickland tells us not to do is to look back with 20/20 hindsight, and that, I think, goes to the whole of this case. Now that we're looking back with 20/20 hindsight, we're trying to essentially backfill and say, well, there was an offer, and sanitization wasn't necessary, although the record at the time and the law of the time would certainly indicate otherwise.
Does the record tell us whether trial counsel knew that the reason the defendant was making the request for all this information was that he had an expert in immigration in California who was asking for it?
I would have to go back and look at those emails in order to check that, but I think it certainly is significant in this case that the defendant was, in fact, consulting with an immigration attorney, and although I know the immigration attorney's declaration states that he didn't have the information available that he needed regarding the elements of third-degree assault with sexual motivation, even taking that, assuming that to be true, which I am, it's not reasonable Because in this day of internet research, I could find that information in virtually any state in a matter of minutes, if not less. So for all of the reasons I've stated and for those set forth in my brief, I would ask the court to affirm the defendant's convictions for two counts of second-degree child molestation and communicating with a minor. Thank you.
These immigration issues come up so often, I think sometimes it's easy to forget that Padilla is only 4 years old, Lafleur's 2 years old. It's not surprising that a particular factual scenario doesn't fit neatly and nicely into every case that's already been decided. We are asking this court to find that although this is not exactly like Lafleur, under the reasoning in Lafleur, the result should be the same. It's not speculation that this would have resulted in a plea deal for assault three with sexual motivation. It's not speculation because, again, it's the prosecutor that floated this, including mentioning it the week before a trial. It's not speculation because we know that Mr. Hazani, the expert, said that had he had the information about assault three, he would have absolutely advised my client to plead to the assault. It's not speculation because my client has said he would have pled to the assault. The state, again, has the only reason that they've said this wouldn't have happened is because they wouldn't have cleansed the record. Here today, they've offered a few more reasons. They talk about the declaration of Mr. Barber. His comments about why the victim wouldn't take a particular plea were made in the context of assault four with sexual motivation. And one of the reasons that the family wouldn't accept that is because it would not require my client to register as a sex offender. That's not an issue with assault three with sexual motivation, where you have to register. And nowhere in Mr. Barber's declaration or in his arguments to the court did he say that the victim's wishes were in any way an impediment to assault three with sexual motivation. It would be surprising if they were, given that he was still sort of urging this on the eve of trial. But there's nothing in the record saying that was the impediment. The only impediment was the powers that be, which he defined as his supervisor. And the only reason that's been given as to why they would have said no is because of the cleansing of the record. And there was no ambiguity on the law in the summer of 2012 on this, even under the expanded approach that had been taken in Aguila. It did not cover this scenario, an age-neutral statute. And, of course, that was confirmed just a few months later when the Ninth Circuit issued its second decision Sanchez v. Avalos, which shows that, in fact, the age-neutral statute does not trigger deportation. Unless the court has any more questions, I would ask you to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all.